And five, correct?
Sir.
And Mr. Bernstein, you're going to go first for 10, I take it?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And Ms. Mendoza, you're going to then go second for with five, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, well, we will make an effort to try to keep your time allocated properly so that we don't infringe on Ms. Mendoza's time. Very well. Ms. Noonan, when you're ready.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, for the record, my name is Nancy Noonan. I am appearing on behalf of plaintiff appellant CC Metals and Alloys, Inc. This case is about the U.S. International Trade Commission's erroneous assumption that an unsuccessful price-fixing conspiracy between three domestic producers of ferrosilicon actually affected prices and prevented normal market forces from determining prices during the so-called conspiracy period. This unreasonable conclusion formed the basis of the ITC's determination that the conspiracy caused any injuries suffered by the domestic industry, rather than finding that the subject imports caused the injury.
Was it unsuccessful or of limited success?
Of limited success.
So there was some success. The conspiracy, they're not great at doing a conspiracy, but they're okay at it.
It was very de minimis, Your Honor. In the one judicial decision we have regarding the successfulness of the conspiracy, the district court, affirmed by the Second Circuit, found that there were basically two sub-periods, about 7 weeks in total, where the conspiracy was successful.
But that was a criminal proceeding where the burdens of proof were different, aren't they?
Yes, they are different,
so
Your Honor.
So Commerce here, an expert agency, who I would suggest may have a little better experience at deciding this than maybe the district court judge, and with completely different burdens, could easily reach a different conclusion about the level of success your plaintiff had at affecting his conspiracy.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that. The commission actually never did any analysis of whether the conspiracy was successful. They assumed that because there was a conspiracy, it must have been successful, and they therefore disregarded.
Let me ask you about how a conspiracy is successful, because if I understand it right, the conspiracy in this case was three companies that have a large share of the market setting a floor for pricing, correct?
They attempted to set the floor, Your Honor.
Okay, well, you say attempted. What that means is maybe somebody didn't abide by the floor, right? That's why it wasn't completely successful, because not everybody held to the floor. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. But so here's the situation. In a free market system, say I'm going to sell you a car and I'm going to be willing to go down as low as $8,000, but I don't want you to know that. So I say, well, I'm trying to get you to buy it for $10. And Judge Bryson over there says he'll sell it to you for $9. And Judge Liz says $8,500. And finally, I have to hit $8,000. That's my rock bottom price. Now, imagine a conspiracy. The three of us sit here and we agree none of us are going to sell the car below $10,000 because we want to maximize our profit and don't want to undercut each other. Oh, but that Bryson character, he says, I'll give it to you for $9,900. He's undercut me by $100. The conspiracy wasn't successful at maintaining the price floor, but it was nonetheless successful in elevating the price, nonetheless.
Your Honor.
So I'm trying to appreciate whether or not Commerce or the Commission in this case might have been very fair in saying we can't really understand or appreciate the market, given that the majority of the market participants were unequivocally engaged in a conspiracy, and that conspiracy would affect the market. Whether it would be successful at having everyone stick to the floor they establish is a different question from whether it would successfully affect the market.
Your Honor,
I just gave you a lot. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
I'm not sure what the question is, but
I'll try to go through all the points I want to make on that. On the issue of the successfulness of the price conspiracy, it's our position that the district court addressed this exactly.
Sentencing judge in the Buffalo
yes.
case.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. The Second Circuit defined this issue, the sentencing issue, of stating that the conspiracy of sellers was intended to counteract falling ferrosilicon prices, that is, to stabilize the prices or even raise them. Such a conspiracy would be successful when the sale price exceeds the price that would have prevailed in the absence of the conspiracy, even if the price increment was less than the competitors hoped for, aimed at. Then, with that guidance, the district court, the sentencing judge, found that there were only these two very short periods where there was some sort of price impact, and that, in fact, the figure associated with that was just a few hundred thousand dollars out of $29 million at issue for CCMA.
Let me ask you this question, and this really is a follow-up to Judge Moore's question. I think you're not going to agree with the premise of my question, but I'll ask it anyway. Suppose the situation is simply this, that there is a conspiracy, there is a floor price that's set among the conspirators. They post that as the price that they're charging, and as a result of the conspiracy, a lot more purchasers buy imported goods, which they can get cheaper. Now, is it fair to say in that setting that there is injury to the domestic industry that's caused by imports?
Your Honor, your question pretty much summarizes the International Trade Commission's position on this issue. And
I guess my question then to you is, why isn't the answer to that, it isn't caused by the imports?
The answer to that, Your Honor, is that we have judicial findings that went to full trial where that was not the case. And I'd like to mention...
What's the that was not the case?
It was not the case that that the price that was set, the target price, was ever achieved.
No, but it doesn't have to be achieved. In other words, what I'm suggesting to you is, if you're willing to assume causation does not exist where the real reason for all the sales of imports is because of an unsuccessful effort among the domestic producers to fix the price at a higher rate, if you assume that's the reason for these lower prices, is that a qualifying reason for finding that there's injury to the domestics caused by imports? And if the answer to that is no, then the conspiracy doesn't have to be successful. In fact, the more unsuccessful the conspiracy is, the more sales the imports get, and it doesn't make any difference. So what's wrong with that way of analyzing the situation?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the evidence on the record of the production costs that the domestic industry was reporting to the commission, and those actual numbers have never been discredited. There's never been any allegation that anyone reported a wrong number. So the production costs that were reported were accurate, and the sales were accurate. And what we see is that the sales that were made by the domestic industry were made at below the cost of production. So that, I believe, is evidence, very substantial evidence, that there was no success in the conspiracy, that there were sales being made by these domestic producers, but those sales were being made at below their cost of production, which is injury, which shows injury to the domestic industry. And on the issue of causation, the statute does not require that the imports be the sole cause or even the primary cause of injury. It just requires that the imports be a cause of injury to the domestic industry. And when we look at the entire period, particularly if we accept that the judicial findings as to the effectiveness of the conspiracy were only for those, you know, little 7-week period of time, we see that there was a lot of injury here. And that, you know,
does the commission have to accept those findings?
I believe that they do have to accept them, or at least they need to weight them compared to other evidence in the record, or do their own analysis as to the effectiveness of the price conspiracy, which they never did. They just said there's a conspiracy. Our assumption is that the conspiracy actually affected prices. Now we've got evidence on the record saying, no, you know, this went to a trial in the steel case, for example.
What evidence did you all proffer that it didn't affect prices? What evidence did you put forward? I mean, you just, I saw certainly you pointed to the findings of the other court, But did you offer the commission evidence?
Well, the evidence we offered, Your Honor, was accurately reporting our sales. We accurately reported our production costs, and again, that's never been in dispute. There's no question that the numbers that were provided to the commission were accurate. It just is how to interpret those numbers that brings us here today. In the steel case, and again, ferrosilicon goes to is used in the production of iron and steel. So there was a what we call the steel case, where we have major purchasers of ferrosilicon who, in a separate proceeding, where it was not disputed that there was a conspiracy to fix prices. The jury was specifically asked, did the plaintiffs, these steel producers, suffer injury in fact to their business or property as a result of a conspiracy to fix the price of ferrosilicon? And the jury's answer was no. No as to all plaintiffs, and no as to all of the conspirators and other members of the domestic industry.
And that was the evidence you introduced to the commission in this case as to why in this case?
That was part of the evidence, Your Honor. I mean, again, our main evidence was the prices we reported were accurate. And when you compare our prices with the prices that were coming in from the imports, there was underselling. And
go ahead.
Okay, and in fact, that underselling was quite significant. You know, during the conspiracy period, it was at least 80%. During the outside periods, it was over 60%. That's a lot of underselling by the imports.
Now, this isn't really fair to bring you back to my question of 10 minutes ago or something, but I just wanted to make sure that I have your answer to the kind of stripped down model of the commission's view of the case. They may tell me that that's not the view of the case, but are you saying that the answer to my little hypothetical is that that's not this case because of all the evidence that you had that takes it out of that model? Or are you saying that in that model there would be injury caused by imports, by the subject imports?
Your Honor,
it's important to me to know that how to think about the overall problem before I get down to dealing with the minutiae of the evidence.
Right. Your Honor, I hope I'm answering your question right and that I remember the question that you'd posed to me. But, you know, we do believe that the evidence does show that the imports cause the injury.
Right.
We've got...
In this case, my hypothetical case would be a case in which, yes, the imports had more sales, but the reason they had more sales was because the conspirators were basically out there thinking that they were going to get together, but they were in fact cutting their own necks.
Right. Your Honor, that's we believe the record doesn't support that.
Well, I understand you say, but if that were the case.
If that were the case, Your Honor, I probably would have to concede that
no causation.
That there would be no causation.
Okay. All right. We'll give you your full rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you.
If you're ready to.
Yes.
Okay. Very well.
Okay.
We'll hear first from Mr. Bernstein.
May it please the court, I'd like to begin by reviewing several pertinent facts the appellant didn't talk about. First fact, it's undisputed in the original investigations the commission's conducted, the producers representing a substantial majority of domestic ferrosilicon producers engaged in fraudulent conduct. They misrepresented themselves as competing exclusively on price. They did this in petition assertions. They did this in hearing testimony. They did this in the questionnaires. There were several findings, both by the commission and by the Court of International Trade to this effect. And the commission relied in its original determinations on the intense price competition in the market, on the assertions that differences of pennies per pound in price could induce a purchaser to switch suppliers in making its affirmative determination. What we haven't heard is how conspiracies, whether partially successful or fully successful, are consistent with the findings made by the commission in its original determination that competition was exclusively on price. This is why the commission instituted reconsideration proceedings, because it was given the wrong information the first time. It was the information on which its opinion was based, the central predicate of that opinion was false. Therefore, it conducted a reconsideration proceeding. It also determined that by providing false responses to the questions, false testimony, that the conspirators impeded the proceeding and the commission was entitled to use adverse best information available, or BIA. Each of the findings that Ms. Noonan has complained about is a BIA finding. Now, generally speaking, this court has said many times in cases involving the Commerce Department that the agency has a good deal of discretion in choosing what facts to use as adverse BIA. The limitation is that it can't choose BIA that's demonstrably incorrect, but it can choose adverse information to have a deterrent effect for misconduct and to basically ensure that parties that withheld information are here impeded.
They won't do it again.
Yes, won't do it again. That's correct, sir. So let's look at what the record provided. There was in the record American Alloys and Elkem, the other two conspirators, pleaded guilty to the criminal antitrust charges. The government provided these plea allocutions in which each one stated that the firm quoted and charged prices consistent with the price-fixing agreement to many of its customers. Both American Alloys and Elkem, at their hearing proceedings, did not contest or admitted that particular aspect of the plea agreement. This served as a direct basis for the ITC's BIA finding that the conspiracy affected prices during the conspiracy period. The ITC also examined, pursuant to this court's precedent, and whether or not the evidence that the BIA finding it made was demonstrably wrong. Here is where the ITC expressly examined the findings the district court made in the SKW criminal proceedings. Now, first of all, what the provision that the SKW court was implying was basically went to a provision in the federal sentencing guidelines then applicable as to the volume of commerce attributable to an individual participant in a conspiracy. We would first subscribe that is not the same inquiry the statute directs the ITC to consider. The statute directs the ITC to consider factors affecting domestic pricing and the market as a whole. Second, what the SKW court found was that the government had provided sufficient proof that the price-fixing conspiracy was successful. We believe, if you look at the record, it was closer to a three-month period than the seven-week period Ms. Noonan referred to. But the government had not proved that the conspiracy had affected prices for other periods. As Judge Moore noted, that wasn't a finding that the conspiracy was totally unsuccessful. Moreover, an important point is a failure of the government to meet its burden to prove a proposition in a criminal proceeding cannot establish proof of the opposite proposition in a dumping investigation. There's a very significant distinction.
Even if the portion of the criminal proceeding is the sentencing proceeding? Now we get into heavy constitutional waters and all the cases leading up to Booker in the Supreme Court, but are you... if the district court was operating under a regime in which the standard of proof was preponderance on sentencing, do you think that there would be collateral estoppel effect in the commission?
No, we don't.
And why not?
Explain why. Well, in a criminal proceeding, the defendant has no burden of production. I mean, the defendant can, basically, it's the defendant's prerogative to make the government prove the case against it. This court has made very clear that anti-dumping investigations don't operate in the same manner. We go here to the Atlantic Sugar case, where the court emphasized that anti-dumping investigations are premised upon the cooperation of all parties. This is something the commission also emphasized in the first decision it issued in the reconsideration proceedings, that it is very important that, particularly with its short deadlines, the commission receive that parties cooperate with information requests and that parties provide the commission with accurate information.
Let me ask a more basic question, though. Do you think, for purposes of collateral estoppel now, that the United States, in the person of the Justice Department, is the same entity for collateral estoppel purposes as the ITC, which is an independent agency, of course?
I would not think so. You also have the difficulty with ITC investigations. The ITC investigations.
Is there any law on that? I'm not aware of that.
I'm not aware of that either.
And you're thinking that it's not would be predicated on what? I mean, help me out here.
Well, the commission is an independent agency. We're not part of the executive branch.
No.
That's partially.
I guess whether it's part of the executive branch is another deep constitutional question. If it's not, which branch is it in?
Well, we're an independent agency.
You're in the fourth branch.
We're not allowed to say that.
I mean,
we're something like the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communication Commission. Again, presidentially appointed commissioners that are confirmed by Congress.
They are appointed by the president.
That is correct.
You're appointed by the president, too.
Touché.
another difficulty with ITC proceedings is that ITC proceedings involve more than one specific party. I mean, they're not adjudicative, and we're dealing with industry participants on both sides, such as Ms. Mendoza's clients, who were certainly not represented in the SKW litigation. But going back to our point, the court has held there's this duty of cooperation here. It's really incumbent that parties give us accurate information. They didn't, so therefore the commission was entitled to use this adverse information available. And therefore the commission properly found that the prices during the conspiracy period were affected by the conspiracy. When you do that, that changes the analysis of the data received quite a bit. Now, Ms. Noonan has emphasized that, well, there's no allegation that the actual pricing data provided the commission was incorrect. We don't contest that, but the commission doesn't evaluate data in the abstract. We have to look at the conditions of competition. The conditions of competition during the conspiracy period were not one of the domestic industry setting prices pursuant to marketplace competition. Because of that, the commission no longer found the conspiracy period underselling observations to be reliable. Therefore, in the fourth remand determination, which is the one before the court, the commission did not include those in the numerator of the ratio that it calculated. And as far as I see, my time seems to be running short. The last point, with respect to the cost of production, first of all, at the time the conspiracy began, they were not selling below the cost of production. If you look at the tables in the ITC reports, which were JA 3024 and 5296, you'll see the first year that the domestic industry's revenues were below its cost of goods sold were 1991, whereas the conspiracy began in 1989. Nevertheless, this court has made clear numerous times that simply a coincidence in time between industry declines in performance and increasing imports is not enough to sustain an affirmative determination. There needs to be a finding of causality, and the commission properly found, because of this conspiracy and because of how it affected the pricing analysis in particular, that causality was lacking. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. And Ms. Mendoza, you're next. We will give you your full 5 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. After 8 years of court proceedings and remands in this case, I think it might be useful just to go back to What really, at this point in time before this court, are the issues that remain. I think there's no dispute that among any of the parties that CCMA engaged in serious misconduct and that a majority of the U.S. industry engaged in serious misconduct before the ITC. I think that based on this court's most recent opinion in Tokyo Kikai, there's no question that the ITC had the ability to reconsider its proceedings given the fraud that had been perpetrated on its process. In that circumstance, it was certainly within the authority of the ITC to conduct that reconsideration proceeding. And in the context of that reconsideration proceeding, the ITC also had the ability to apply adverse inferences. In fact, it had the express statutory authority to do so. And I don't think CCMA disputes this. I think that given that that is in fact the case, that the ITC had expressed statutory authority to apply adverse inferences, that the ITC also, based on court precedents, had broad discretion in deciding what those adverse inferences should be. And the ITC took the position that the fraud and the misconduct and the misrepresentations were so broad that it needed to take a very broad view of what adverse inferences it needed to draw with respect to the record. And I think the issue here for the ITC certainly was not did the conspirators reach the target price, but in fact was a much broader question along the lines of some of the judges' questions here today, which were, well, can you explain wouldn't it have been relevant to the ITC to know that when certain conspirators were cheating on the conspiracy, they might have driven prices down themselves, i.e. they might have brought prices down in the whole marketplace by trying to drive down and compete on the basis or undercut the whole conspiracy. And I think that would have been another relevant consideration that the ITC would have wanted to take into account to determine what was actually affecting prices. The other way that the ITC considered that prices that the marketplace could have been affected was also volumes. As Judge Bryson said, if in fact conspirators are setting a price way above the market price and refusing to sell below it, then imports could come in and sell at market prices, and that would be a relevant consideration that the ITC would want to know. And the ITC basically concluded that its entire record was so tainted that it was required to take an adverse inference with respect to all of these issues. I don't think that the court's reasoning in DNL Supply, which is cited by the petitioners in their reply brief, it contradicts this conclusion. In fact, in that case, this court said the issue is whether the plaintiff says the issue based on DNL Supply before this court is whether the price-fixing conspiracy affected prices during the conspiracy period is conclusively demonstrated to be wrong and cannot be used as best information under any test. This is at 9 of their reply brief. We agree with this standard. We agree that, in fact, this court would have to find that there was evidence in the record that conclusively demonstrated the ITC's adverse inference, i.e. that prices were affected during the conspiracy, was wrong. And they have pointed to no such evidence in their briefs or before the court today, other than to point to decisions in separate criminal proceedings involving different standards of proof and questioning very different issues. To conclude,
what do you? You represent private party. What's your view as to the collateral estoppel effect of a position? An adjudication involving the United States vis-a-vis the ITC?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding is that the precedents are that the United States oftentimes is not held responsible for everything that happens in every court and every proceeding in which it's a party.
The United States? I mean, well, if the United States loses a case in Kotzebue, Alaska, then it is collateral estoppel on the United States in another case in Fort Myers, Florida.
Right. I mean, the fact of the matter is, in this case, I think the issue is different because you really had, first of all, you didn't have all the parties present. You certainly didn't have us present in the proceedings, in the criminal proceedings. The issues there was no identity of issues in the proceeding before the criminal court.
Right, but what I'm really getting at is, do you take a position, as Mr. Bernstein did? He says, no, we're not part of the United States for these purposes. We may get a green check, but that's it. What's your position on that? Is the ITC subject at all to collateral estoppel?
I believe that under certain circumstances, they might be, but I think for a particular agency of the U.S. government that the court would exercise a high standard in determining whether it, as a part of the United States, should be subject to collateral estoppel in all proceedings in which any agency of the U.S. government were a party.
Okay. Do you have a concluding thought? I interrupted you.
No, I think I had concluded.
Very well. Thank you. And Ms. Noonan, we will hear a rebuttal now, please.
May it please the court. First, I would like to clarify the record regarding the duration of the conspiracy. Mr. Bernstein was correct. It is more like 12 weeks. I was thinking of there was a seven-week period from February to April of 1991, and then there was another finding in the sentencing proceeding of May 29 to June 30, 1991. We believe that we did accurately respond to the questionnaire responses. CCMA was not a petitioner in the investigation, but it was obligated to respond to the questionnaire and did so. It is CCMA's position, our position, that there was intense price competition in the market. And we saw the Second Circuit acknowledge that the conspiracy came about by the domestic producers trying to counteract the pressure, the price pressure from these imports. And the questions, the very open-ended questions in the ITC's questionnaire, we believe we answered them accurately, that there was no price leader and that prices are set by market forces. On the issue of this standard of review, a standard of evidence, the burden of proof in the sentence, the criminal case, we would like to point to the civil case where it is a preponderance of evidence standard, and this is the Steele case that we discussed earlier. And again, in that case, with all of the...
This is the Western District of Pennsylvania litigation?
Yes, sir.
Of course, the U.S. was not a party to that, I take it.
That's correct.
So there's no collateral estoppel there.
That's right.
It's just evidence.
It's just evidence, right, which, you know, again, going to a full trial on the exact issue of, you know, whether there was a price impact and the jury finding no, you know, we believe it's very powerful evidence and should be given a substantial weight. The point we are asking, that we're here to do, is to ask the court to require the commission to actually do the analysis of whether the conspiracy actually affected prices. We believe that if they were to do such an analysis, that the answer would be no, it didn't, but no analysis has been done. It's always been just this best information available standard that they have used to assume that the conspiracy affected prices. Let's see. My final point is regarding Mr. Bernstein's comment that that the domestic industry was not selling below their cost of production during the entire conspiracy and during the entire review period. We provided evidence on the record, which is cited in our brief, that the sales below the cost of production started in 1990. So while when you look at the commission's record for 1990 as a whole calendar year, it doesn't show sales below cost, although it's pretty close that we're about to get there, and then you see the sales below cost for the calendar year 91-92 and for the six-month period of 93 that the commission collected data for. So in conclusion, we just want to say, to summarize, what we're asking the court to do is direct the commission to perform an analysis rather than just to infer.
In one word, you don't like BIA here.
We don't believe the record allows for BIA here because BIA can't be used when it's been thoroughly discredited, which we believe it has.
Thank you, Ms. Noonan, Mr. Bernstein, Ms. Mendoza. Thank you. The case is submitted.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.